I want to tell you about an event so notably rare it deserves to be mentioned and remembered. Indeed, it deserves great study. I believe understanding such an event could lead to critical advances in this community, perhaps in all society. The event I'm remembering happened one Tuesday afternoon 3 years ago during a church staff meeting when I was struck dumb. By struck dumb, of course, I mean not that I had dumb things to say, that's not headline news to anyone, but rather it references a specific moment where I had nothing to say. No words, no suggestions, no gripping critical analysis of the situation. Nothing. Of course, as is often the case with those struck dumb, my mouth kept moving out of habit. Stammerings continued pouring forth, but no words. I was, for the first time in my ministerial career that I can remember, wordless. It could even be a precedent for all ministers everywhere. So, what led to this rare event? Simple. Witnessing an appearance of love in the wild. The Tuesday in question, my office administrator asked to speak with me a full 20 minutes before our regularly scheduled staff meeting. She and I got along very well and we liked one another, but never had she ever asked for one of our meetings to last a single minute longer than it needed. I inquired if she had something to bring up. She nodded. So I suggested that we start with that, but I was completely unprepared when she reached out and showed me a beautiful new ring and announced she was getting married. What you have to know is that my office administrator was nearly 70 years old. She had been married 3 times before that. And she had a habit of referring to her previous marriages as World War I, the Civil War, and the War to End All War. She spoke of herself as an escaped prisoner of war who vowed never to return into captivity. I listened. I was wordless. It's funny, we who have spent our lives trying to tame love rather than being tamed by it have a tendency to forget what love looks like in the wild, to picture love in its natural habitat with its power to mesmerize us, to arrest our attention, suspend even the common sense that we work so hard to employ to avoid looking like a fool. Love in the wild is a wonder to behold, rare, powerful, even holy. When you see it, you stop everything, knowing it is something to be revered. Seeing it can even render you wordless. Which brings me to the title of this morning's sermon, which many of you have mentioned being confounded by, trying to make sense of. Finding love is like traveling to a foreign yak farm. So let me explain by reading this passage written a number of years ago by Thuten Yigme Norbu. Thuten Yigme Norbu is the elder brother of Tenzin Gyatso, who was identified as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama. And as is the custom, when he was identified as the reincarnation of the Dalai Lama, he was taken very early in life from his family to the Lhasa Temple in Tibet, where he was to study for many years. His elder brother, many times out of great love, made the trek from Kumbum in Amdo across the mountainous Himalayan trails to the temple. On one of his earliest trips, he wrote this account. Before long, the trail led to a place where I was to see the vast herds of wild yaks with my own eyes. The sight of those beautiful and powerful beasts who've made their home on Tibet's high and barren plateau has never ceased to fascinate me. Somehow, these shy creatures manage to sustain themselves on the stunted grass roots, which is all that nature provides in those parts. And what a wonderful sight it is to see a great herd of them plunging head down into a wild gallop across the steppes. The earth shakes under their heels and a vast cloud of dust marks their passage. At night, they will protect themselves from the cold by huddling up together with the calves in the center. They will stand like this in a snowstorm, pressed so close together that the condensation from their breath rises up into the air in a single column of steam. The nomads have occasionally tried to take these young calves and domesticate them, but they have never been entirely successful. Somehow, when these yaks are bred in captivity, they lose their astonishing strength and power of endurance, and they are no use at all as pack animals, because their backs immediately get sore. Their relationship with humans has therefore remained that of game and hunter. Norbu depicts a truly noble and majestic scene of yaks in the wild, but in listening to it, I was struck by how it could also be an apt description of what love might look like in the wild. How we have to travel a long way to find love, far from our own habits, far from our routines or anything familiar. And when we come upon it, we are often out of breath. We find it so captivating because it is foreign to us, so different, almost like it speaks an entirely different language. We don't assume anything about it as though we know how it should behave. We notice that love is shy and sustains itself sometimes on very little, that it has great power, enough to make the earth around us shake. It instinctively surrounds and protects what is young and vulnerable. It forms packs and finds a common breath which can rise into a single column of steam to the heavens. And especially interesting, it refuses to be domesticated. When it is captured and taken out of its element, it grows weak, gets sore, and can't carry the load that we hoped it would. It makes me wonder, when I think about this idea of love in the wild, if the love so commonly found in our culture today is actually love that has been lassoed and dragged back out of its natural element, a love that has lost some of its original natural wildness, a love that has become listless. Until one morning we wake up and look across the breakfast table and notice that this once beautiful and majestic animal that we have spent so much time with looks a lot like a yak. And not like the kind that you once admired. No, this yak is heavier than you remember and shaggier. And it's not carrying the load you expected. And you yourself are feeling weaker and more tired and cut off from the herd. And frankly, your back has become sore and you don't remember how this all happened, how it got to this point when you began feeling so worn down instead of built up. Now, I could at this point ask how many of us here have felt this way. But I realize that would be hard, that you might actually be sitting next to the yak at this very moment. And it would be awkward to admit or feeling doubt or disappointment or acknowledging the urge to go up into the attic and look for your passport, missing the call of the wild and wondering whether it was ever really supposed to be this hard. But I'm not. I'm not going to ask you that because I know it's true for all of us, especially when we stop to realize if we have in our minds reduced what I've been talking about to romantic love, then we will have missed a great part of the role that love plays in our lives. The yak that is in your life may be the one that lays next to you in the bed or sits across from you at the family table or works in the adjacent cubicle at work or is down the aisle from you in church. We are all each other's yaks. And I name our yakishness in all of its cherished as well as its challenging ways. We are, every one of us, majestic and beautiful, spirited and tender. There is a part of us that is always wild and free, and there is a part of us that is also frightened and timid, selfish and judgmental. The question is, how do we get back to that part of ourselves we seem to have left behind? How do we recall the majesty that we lost? Recall the power that we have forgotten? It takes a journey. Listen again to the instructions from Carl Dennis in his poem, Invitation. Just allow time to get lost before arriving. So many roads are ready to take you forward into the empty world to come, misty with promises. So few will lead you back to what you have missed. Just get an early start. Call in sick to the office this once. Postpone your vacation a day or two. Prepare to find the road neglected, the street signs rusted, the school dark, the doors locked, the windows broken. This is where the challenge comes in. Do you suppose anything really great could have been discovered if the inventors had been deterred by confusion, or if pioneers had been discouraged by feeling uncomfortable? It is important to understand that most of the problems we have with love emerge when we try to domesticate love. Even though it is our natural impulse to do so, even though our culture conditions us to do just that, it is not our calling to domesticate love. It is love's greatest attribute that it is able to domesticate us. If our egos can endure the humility required, we are not supposed to bring love into our world so much as we are called to figure out how to live in its world. We do not tame and transform love, but the other way around. Most of you are familiar with the wise rejoinder that if you want to make God laugh, tell her your plans. But stop for a moment and integrate the very common theology among us that God is love. And you can probably understand the corollary of that rejoinder, which states that love, true love, not Hallmark love, but true love, does not care one whit about your plans. Love is not swayed by your opinions or preferences, by what is convenient or natural for you. Love does not care about the language that you speak or the customs or rituals or traditions that you follow. It is not concerned with how your parents did it or what your friends say or the advice column in Cosmo. Love is only interested in cultivating tenderness, noticing what is sensitive and vulnerable that lives in you, and putting that at the center of the herd. And yet most of us have a hard time living our entire life on this forming edge of awareness, with this level of vulnerability, where sensitivity but also great amazement are possible. It's demanding and exhausting to live in that wild place. So much so, we often end up dragging back love into our habitat, back into our habits and routines, until it learns how to behave itself, a process which weakens love. The problem is that once we have love properly domesticated, we miss the power that we knew it once had. We miss its majesty, its wildness. But our pleas end up sounding like nagging, because although we were once rendered wordless by the yak across from us, who once spoke to us like no one else ever had, we never fully learned to speak its language. Enter marriage counselor Dr. Gary Chapman. Chapman worked for years with couples at every stage of marriage and at pivotal points in their relationships, from those just discovering the joys and trials of marriage to those who were ready to call it quits. And after many years of counseling, he started to notice a pattern. And he noticed what he believed were actually five primary ways people learn to express and interpret love. And these he called the five love languages. These five ways are words of affirmation, quality time, receiving gifts, acts of service, and physical touch. What's more, Chapman developed a theory that although almost everyone is conversant in some way in all five languages, we each have a primary or dominant love language. And he even developed a test available online which will determine your natural love language. But perhaps more interesting, he found that for whatever reason, people are usually drawn to those who speak a different love language than their own. To give you an example, I took that test online, and it showed that I tested highest for, you can probably guess, words. I love words. That's how I understand and recognize love. That is not, however, how Liz understands and recognizes love. And so many times during our arguments, she would say something like, "Too many words. Please stop talking." To her, I became a yak, 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 yak. And I have learned that in those moments, she could only understand love that was being spoken in her language, which was physical touch. Her motto would be, "I don't care what you know until I know that you care." My motto would be, well, it doesn't matter what my motto would be, because we never got to my motto. Because it breaks down before that. Fear floods in, and we begin to drown in doubt. All that matters in those moments is time and dreams unfulfilled, and trying to imagine what it will take to bring time and our dreams back together again. Any disagreement can be the hill that we die on if we don't quickly learn how to become multilingual. We drown in fear until we are willing to translate and become conversant in the other's language. The good news about all of this is that it doesn't mean that because you disagree with someone you love, because you sometimes lose sight of love, that you have lost love. Sometimes it is a matter of noticing when love has become weak because we have tried to domesticate it, because we've corralled it in our habitat and insisted that it speak a language it is not familiar with. That's when you know it's time to go back to that place that you discovered it, back to the majesty and the wonder where you first observed your partner in their natural element. That's when you know it may be time for a new journey, a journey that perhaps you failed to complete long ago. Listen to these words by poet David White in this piece called The True Love. There is a faith in loving fiercely, that which is truly yours to love, especially if you have waited years, and especially if part of you never really believed you could deserve this kind of love and beckoning hand as it's held out to you in this way. I am thinking of faith now and the testaments of loneliness and what we feel we are worthy of in this world. Years ago in the Hebrides, I remember an old man who walked every morning on the gray stones to the shore with the baying seals, who would press his hat to his chest in the blustering salt wind and say his prayer to the turbulent Jesus hidden in the water. And I think of the story of the storm and everyone waking and seeing the distant yet familiar figure far across the water calling to them, and how we are all preparing for that abrupt waking and that calling and that moment we have to say yes, except it will not come so grandly, so biblically, but more subtly and intimately in the face of the one you know you look at in the mirror, the one you know you have to love, so that when we finally step out of the boat toward them, we find everything holds us and confirms our courage. And if you wanted to drown, you could, but you don't. Because finally, after all the struggle and all the years, you don't want to anymore. You've simply had enough drowning. And you know you want to live. And you know you want to love. And you know you will walk across any territory and any darkness, however fluid and however dangerous, to take the one hand that you know truly belongs in yours. I believe that the greatest challenge love presents to all of us is learning to truly love ourselves into wholeness, a wholeness that we discover becomes so overwhelming and overflowing, our only choice is how to give it away. If you find yourself one day soon lucky enough to witness love in the wild, and you are struck dumb, and you are filled with wonder and appreciation and amazement, be still. Summon reverence. Let go of whatever language you usually speak so that you may learn to speak another. See if you can decipher a language that is trying to lead you somewhere essential, somewhere unfamiliar, a place of great power. That's when you can be sure that love is really present and that you will not drown, because love will hold you. That's when you know that you can be held by a love greater than you can imagine, that it is there to sweep you up and call you home to the glory of life.